At this point, it's my great honor to introduce our guest presenter today, Dr. George Garvey. I'm certainly biased as someone who has had bypass surgery to welcome him to speaking today. George was born and raised on a farm in Churchbridge. Upon graduating from the College of Medicine, he practiced general medicine in Estevan for 8 years, 71 to 79, as well as serving as chief of staff at St. Joseph's Hospital. From 79 to 84, George was a resident in medicine and a fellow in cardiology, becoming an interventional cardiologist in Regina from 84 to 2015. Over the years, he has held a number of key positions, including the head of a section of cardiology at the General Hospital, Saskatchewan representative on the National Council of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons for 2 terms, and Saskatchewan Medical Association representative on the Senate of the U of R. George is married to Lena and has 2 sons. It's with great pleasure I bring forward Dr. George Garvey.
I heard Joe's story, and when I was a medical student, people would ask me questions, and I would say, "Well, I haven't taken that yet. I don't know." And then I became a general. Then I became a general practitioner for 8 years, and people expected me to know everything. It was really tough. Then I went, so I decided to do something easier, and I became a specialist. Now I can say, it's not my field, sorry. But and that's a fact. So thank you very much for the privilege of allowing me to address you. I'd like to start with a few caveats. I claim to have a few insights into how doctors think, but have no claim to special expertise. If you have 3 doctors, you'll have 4 opinions, and I'm just giving you my opinion, okay? You may recall the famous quote of Roger Bacon. Now, there are 4 chief obstacles in grasping truth which hinder every man, however learned, and scarcely allow anyone to win a clear title to learning. Namely, submission to faulty and unworthy authority, influence of custom, popular prejudice, and the concealment of our own ignorance accompanied by an ostentatious display of our own knowledge. So that's just to warn you. We have different subconscious expectations, probably you and I, of what this is going to be about today. And I've talked to some people, and there are expectations. And it reminds me of a cartoon I once saw in a magazine. It was the husband and wife, or the bride and groom, rather, standing at the altar for their wedding. And there are little bubbles above their heads saying inside what they were really thinking. And above the man's head, the groom's head, it said, "Now I'll be able to have sex whenever I want." And over the ladies, it said, "Now I'll never have to have sex again." So, and that might be a problem today. We might have a difference in expectations. The last caveat is that I am a Unitarian, and our Unitarian principles are accepting of one another. However, during question period, if you disagree on any comments, it's open season, so don't feel bad about asking me. Doctors are regular human beings, subject to all the lack of knowledge, lack of empathy, or imperfect motivations of anyone else in society. Sometimes, to protect themselves from anxiety, patients deny their doctors possible failings. We want to believe that our doctor knows everything. The choice of careers in medicine is very broad, and physicians self-select their field to match their individual needs and aptitudes. For example, a psychiatrist may be more inclined to human interaction than a pathologist. Cardiologists generally find a field with few areas of ambiguity and uncertainty, clear-cut. Any field of medicine combines science, which provides clear facts, with the art of dealing with ambiguities and uncertainties and the humanity of the patient. As medical science advances, more and more areas fall under the umbrella of science rather than art. While understanding of the patient as a person and the ability to relate and communicate are very important, at the end of the day, the important result will depend on the application of objective scientific logic or knowledge and an evidence-based approach. Evidence-based medicine is now standard, and I'll discuss it a bit. The scientific method is applied to the methods of diagnosis and treatment. Common sense has been shown to have a capacity to seriously mislead medical treatment. This is the most important lesson that I've learned in 50 years of medical practice. It's counterintuitive. And I'll tell you one of my early experiences. When I was a GP in Estevan, we knew that cholesterol was bad, and we knew that for every 1% we lowered cholesterol, we could cut down cardiac events by 2%. But we have no tools to do that. We had diet, which nobody followed, and we had what they call the resins. It's powders that absorb the cholesterol from the gut and goes through. It makes you pass a lot of gas, and you're bloated, and it tastes terrible. So we had no real tools. And then, lo and behold, a pill came out, the first pill that you could take to lower cholesterol effectively. It was called clofibrate. It was a fibrate, or Atramid S. And there were big ads in the medical journals. It was a big deal. This drug was out. And I was in a very busy clinic in Estevan, and we had a lab tech full-time in our office. And so we bought her a kit to test cholesterol. And then if we saw a patient that came in that had fat, high blood pressure, diabetes, smoker, bad family history, high-risk patient, we'd test their cholesterol. And if the cholesterol was high, we'd put them on Atramid S. Common, obviously, thing to do, eh? You've suddenly got this tool. And around the time that I left practice and went back to my training, the World Health Organization randomized trial came out, and it randomized people with high cholesterol to Atramid S or placebo, blanks. And it did lower cholesterol effectively. It did reduce the events of cardiac deaths, but overall there were more deaths in the treated group than in the placebo group. So the one that took the medication were more likely to die. And I'd given this probably to some of my friends. I was out there, maybe overstating this, but killing my friends in the best possible intentions, the most useful common sense approach that you could do. Everybody did it. I mean, it was the rage. So we have to be careful about our evidence. As a cardiologist, I'm more comfortable in precise, clear-cut diagnostic information. With respect to relating to the patient, we don't have a lot of time. We concentrate on detecting depression, which is common in heart patients and can be deadly, and best managed by a psychiatrist. So we work with the psychiatrist in these patients, and we look for methods of motivating the patient to comply with lifestyle and medication use. So that's what the interactions are. Pretty narrow sometimes, although most of our patients don't linger. They either do well or die, and so we don't have that issue so much as in when I was a family doctor. It was quite different. Our objective in the initial interaction with the patient is to first to find out what is wrong and decide what to do. Our prime objective and duty is to not make an error in diagnosis and treatment. We want to understand in the most fundamental way what is happening that is not right. That's what we call pathophysiology. We want to understand what's happening. Then, based on our understanding of the disruption of normal biologic processes, we can devise a plan to interfere with the abnormal process and restore normal function. We try to apply the basic principles of critical thinking. Critical thinking, that is the rational, skeptical, unbiased evaluation of factual evidence. We also understand the problem from the patient's point of view so that we can fully relate to their perception of what must be done and why. If we are exceptionally lucky, this can be done in a multidisciplinary environment, which I happen to have now for what I'm doing, which is fabulous. This must be done efficiently as possible within the time restraints of the healthcare delivery system in which we are working. And you've probably waited for doctors and thought that they didn't spend enough time, but you have to recognize that doctor works probably on an average of 50 to 80 hours a week. So there's only a limited, the resource is limited. It's fundamental economics. Demand exceeds supply. So we have to work in that environment. We must be evidence-based. That is, we must deal with reality. There are three levels of evidence. The first is case experience or anecdotal, which may be useful in most obvious situations, but when there is any degree of complexity, it isn't reliable. An apparent response to treatment may be due to the natural course of the disease. That's why we sometimes laughingly say if we see a patient with a self-limiting disease, we should treat them quickly so we get credit for what happens, because it happened anyway. Or the placebo effect due to the desire, and the placebo effect is hard to define. It probably consists of the desire of the patient or the doctor to believe that the treatment is effective. And then there's something called statistical regression to the mean, which I could talk at another time, but it's too complicated. But it's a statistical phenomenon. The second level of evidence is the observational study or the cohort study. A large population of patients is evaluated and then reevaluated at a later date to see if any factors can be identified that can affect the course of the disease. These studies are plagued by confounding factors such as unrecognized characteristics or environmental factors or some things that we don't really know what it was. And the common one that people talk about, the really dramatic one, was the use of hormone replacement therapy in menopausal women. And so the thinking on this was, women are protected from coronary artery disease until they reach menopause. Then their incidence of coronary artery disease rises to parallel that of men. So it seemed, and that's when their hormones cut out. So it seemed, again, logical, common sense, that that's what's happening. That's the cause of it. And that hormone replacement should affect this. It should benefit them. So it should reduce their risk of heart disease. So there was a large study done. I'm not going to go into the details of these, but there was a large study called the Nurses' Health Study, where there was an observational study, and they asked thousands of nurses, do you take hormone replacement therapy, Premarin, or do you not? And then they went back afterwards and saw how many were still around, how many had heart attacks, blah, 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 cancer, and so on. And from that they concluded that it did appear that the hormone replacement therapy did protect against coronary artery disease. They benefited. They were less, but they were self-selected. You just went and asked them, do you take it or not? Then later they did a large trial called the Women's Health Study, where they randomized patients. So they took a large number of patients, thousands, half got hormone replacement therapy, half didn't, purely on a random basis. And when they did that study, they found that the incidence of heart attack was higher in the women that got prednisone than the ones that, or pardon me, Premarin than the ones that didn't. And so it upset what was common sense, and what seemed to be shown in this observational study was contradicted when a randomized trial was done. And there are all kinds of arguments about this. Every time something like this comes out that contradicts what industry says, and then all their shills and defenders and so on come out with all kinds of angles to try and protect that. But that was the gist of it, the fundamental gist of it. I have to tell you the worst possible news. All the data on red wine is observational. Okay? There's no randomized trial of red wine versus no red wine. In fact, there was something I read. I haven't got it yet, but I've looked it up. But it came out in The Lancet, a very, very reputable journal, apparently published an analysis of multiple multiple observational studies of alcohol versus no alcohol, and they say that the safe level of alcohol is at zero. It used to be one drink per today for women and two for men or something like that. This is all observational. And observational data is useful in raising the question, is this a factor or not? But the answer has to come from a randomized trial. The most reliable evidence, it comes from randomized, preferably double-blind trials where the subjects are divided into two groups, randomly assigned to different treatments, often an active treatment versus placebo. Ideally, these are blinded so that the subjects are unaware of which group they're in because they don't, to avoid bias, and for the best studies, double-blinded, so neither the doctor nor the patient knows the assigned treatment. So there's no chance of any bias in this because we want to believe what we're doing is right. Doctors want to believe it. Patients want to believe it. These are not perfect. They're the best we have. There are lots of problems. I could go into that. That's in the whole lecture of the problems with randomized trials. But they're the best we've got. even then the evidence is not uncommonly attacked by commercial interests or quack organizations or groups with underlying suspicion of scientific medicine, sometimes they are harmless, sometimes they're dangerous. I brought a book along about pharma, one of them. Guy who says there are problems, and they mentions this issue with the Premier and so on. And so there are books on this if you want to read it. And now in this process, which we're trying to apply the best possible knowledge to our patient, doctors must be aware of cognitive errors and try to avoid them. That's things that are going on in our brain. There are psychological processes that affect every human in many situations. Primary care medicine has been compared to watching a train go by watching for a face. If you become distracted, you may miss the face. Sometimes the train speeds up, so it's very difficult to be alert. So we work on pattern recognition, particularly in primary care, because there's so many cases and you have so much less time and less knowledge, in-depth knowledge, whereas a specialist, you have more time, more in-depth knowledge, is much easier. But in any case, doctors use what we call heuristics. A heuristic is a simple procedure that helps find adequate, though often imperfect, solutions to difficult questions. It's like intuition. We're looking at the sky. The sky is cloudy. It's going to rain, we think. But what is the exact probability? We make an assumption on that. So that, and there are various errors in our thinking, in our brain, that we make every day in every situation, because you have to decide quick. You look at somebody walking down the street. Are they going to rob you, or are they going to smile and shake your hand? You make a quick decision. You don't look at all the rational thoughts and so on, and that's what we have to do in medicine. So there are a bunch of errors that we can make. We're done for time, okay? The one is the availability error, and this is the tendency to judge the likelihood of an event by the ease in which the relative samples come to mind. So something is happening, it's common, and so you make that assumption that this is what it is. You see a bunch of people walking by wearing nice suits, you assume that they're going to be very sophisticated people or so on. And I'll tell you a case of mine. This is when I was in family medicine, when I was practicing in Estevan, I was a member of the College of Family Physicians of Canada, which is a national organization. And they did a survey. They were trying to, this is back in the 70s, they're trying to track what has happening with influenza in the country. So they got volunteers from across the country, here and there, every different town and so on, and they gave them kits to diagnose flu. Where is flu? Which flu is it? What virus is it? Where is it showing up? And so we were told that we got a package of six different kits and for six different patients. And the first six patients we saw with flu, we should fill this all out. The two-page form, there was a throat swab, a blood test, and then there's a gargle. You have to put this milky stuff in your throat, gargle it, and spit it in to try and capture this virus. So we did all six kits. So I did my six kits and sent them off for the first six cases of flu that I got. And when I got my reports back, one of them was infectious mono, okay? And I'd missed the infectious mono because everybody was coming in with flu. Like some of those days, we'd see 30 patients in an afternoon because there's such a rush of patients with flu. And in this sea of patients, the infectious mono was there, but I didn't pick it up because I made the availability error. Now, if that had been one patient had walked in and there had been no flu in the community, I'd have probably looked at that patient differently. Maybe I'd have picked it up. Maybe I wouldn't have. You can make that error. I mean, it's not unknown to miss a diagnosis of infectious mono, that's for sure. There's another error, the representativeness error. Your thinking is guided by a prototype, so you fail to consider possibilities that contradict the prototype. And I'm going to show you a book in a minute where this is all stolen. This is all plagiarized from a book called How Doctors Think that inspired the title of this talk that I'll show you later. And this guy, he was talking about a patient that came in with chest pain, but he was a young guy. He was skinny. He was a jogger. Didn't smoke. Nothing to suggest cardiac disease. Okay, nothing at all. I mean, some of these people, they're walking heart attacks. You know immediately. You know, they got a family, all these things. But this guy didn't. And because so the doc in this case, this wasn't the doc in this case, missed the diagnosis initially because it just didn't fit. You have all these, you have this idea, this thing in your head of what this should look like, and if it doesn't look like it, you miss it. There's an anchoring error that can be made. The patient doesn't consider multiple possibilities, but quickly and firmly latches onto a single one, supported by confirmation bias, confirming what you expect to select and selectively accepting or ignoring information. So you see something, you decide what it is. And on the basis of that, then you go on from there and you have this confirmation error where if something contradicts it, you ignore it, and if something confirms it, you take it. It's like, I don't have any medical examples, but I think sometimes this happens in police investigations. You hear it, where the police pick up somebody, this kid from Saskatoon that was in jail for many years. I forget his name. Anyway, they made that error because they picked up the wrong guy, the wrong kid, and then after that, a confirmation error, they try to find reasons to justify it and ignored the contradictory facts. So we can all, this is in all people. I think Donald Trump supporters, I don't want to get political, but I think Donald Trump supporters might have this anchoring error. They get hooked on this one thing, and then from then on, they only watch, so-called channel, Fox News. They only watch Fox News and so on. And I'll tell you a case. What am I doing here? Case of mine. There was a lady that came in. I was a family doc in Estevan. And a lady came in. I thought she was getting a little old. Now I think she was young. It depends on how you look at it. She was a mature lady, a lady of a certain age, and she had abdominal pain. She had pain in her belly, and there are many causes for that. So I took her history, I examined her, poked here, poked there, did all the tests, and then I couldn't figure out what it was. So I had her, we didn't have CT scans in those days, so I did a GI series. You swallow the barium, goes through the stomach, the esophagus, the stomach, and the duodenum, and you can see if there's any lesions there, ulcers and so on. It was for ulcers, gastritis, so nothing. So I did a barium enema. The concern there is underlying cancer, so cancer of the colon. So she had a barium enema, nothing. So then I said, well, I'll get an IVP, because sometimes you have kidney stones or things going on in the kidney that you don't take. So I got an IVP, which you inject dye intravenously. It goes out through the kidneys, so it outlines the kidneys and the entire urine collecting system. Nothing. So now I'm really puzzled, so I didn't know what to do. And I had a senior partner in the practice in Estevan, Dr. Viswanathan. I don't know if any of you ever came across him. And he was a general surgeon. So that's, they deal with abdomens all the time, abdominal problems. So I thought, well, I'll get him to have a look. I'll hand it over the patient, to Dr. Viswanathan. And he saw the patient. And a couple of days later, he said, you know, George, I think she's depressed. And he put her on some antidepressants and she got better. So I completely focused on an organic idea for this abdominal pain. I completely missed it, and fortunately a smarter, more mature doctor, experienced, picked it up. The attribution error. Your thinking is guided by a prototype and you fail to consider possibilities that can trick the prototype. Contradict the prototype. It might be a negative stereotype. So you see an alcoholic comes in and their liver isn't that good. This is the one that he mentioned in the book. The guy had liver disease. He was an alcoholic, so obviously he's an alcoholic liver, but he actually had a rare condition called Wilson's disease, and it was missed for some time because every time anybody saw him in the emergency room, they said, oh, alcoholic, you know. Then there's another one is the affective error. We prefer what we hope will happen to a less appealing alternative. We're sympathetic, so avoid the uncomfortable course that is actually necessary. So we like the patient, their friend, they're a nice person. And then there's something that's not right. It's and they have to have a bad test or something like this, and we try to avoid that because we really don't. We don't want to push something bad on this patient. So the pattern of error starts from we start with a mental prototype. We jump to a conclusion because that's how we have to work. We work with these heuristics because we don't have time to go in depth in every single case. It's not possible. Then we retreat from we go away from the rare things because they're rare, so not likely to see them. And then once you get that diagnostic momentum, then we keep confirming it. So that's a trap that we can fall into, and we always try to be, when we're thinking, we realize this, and we try to avoid as best we can, but it's hard. Oh, my time. I'm gonna try to get this as quickly as I can. There's a fundamental tool that we use, statistical tool that we use to assess what's the diagnostic information. It's called Bayes' theorem. And I'll read the description of it for those of you who are statisticians, and then I'll give this again in English. So Bayes' theorem, named after an 18th century mathematician, Thomas Bayes, is a mathematical formula for determining conditional probability. The theorem provides a way to revise existing predictions or theories given new evidence or additional evidence. And this was really developed in the field of exercise tests, which is my field, but it's spread widely through medicine. The thinking is widely through medicine. So you got a test, and it's not perfect. If somebody has chest pain, we do a treadmill test. And that stresses the heart, and if the ST segment on the ECG drops by more than a millimeter, that's abnormal. That suggests there's lack of oxygen to the heart, and we proceed in that direction. So it's a quick test. It's cheap. It's safe. It's easy. It's a very useful test. However, it's not perfect, and it has a false positive rate of at least 10%. I'm going to say today but it's probably higher than that, but say 10% for argument's sake. So if you take 100 normal people off the street and test them, 10 of them are going to have a positive test. It's just the limitation of the test. So you use that test now, and it's widely used for sorting out stress, chest pain. So if you have a patient who's a 70-year-old man with hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoked 2 packs a day, all his brothers died of heart attack at age 50, that guy is highly likely to have coronary artery disease. It may be, if you had 100 of those guys, at least 90 of them would have coronary artery disease. So now you've got a population of 100 of these guys, and you test them with a stress test. 90 of them have a positive test because they have the disease. There are 10 of them that don't have the disease. 10% or 1 has a false positive. So now you've got 91 tests positive. 1 is wrong, 90 are right. That's pretty good. You take another population of 20-year-old women with no diabetes, no high blood pressure, no high cholesterol, never smoked, and all their grandparents lived to be 95. The incidence of coronary artery disease in that population is virtually zero, say 1% for argument's sake. You take a population with a 101 with 1% probability, you stress them. Out of those 100, you get the one true positive, and of the 99 that are normal, you get a 10% false positive rate, which is 10. Now you have 11 tests, of which one is correct. So the test is exactly the same test, same criteria, so on. The only difference is who you tested. What is the pretest probability? So that's something that we're always thinking about in medicine. It was developed by a couple of guys in San Francisco back in the 70s and in stress testing, but it's widely applied now in medical thinking. I've got much time. Okay, now to understand the topic of how doctors think better, I recommend that you read How Doctors Think by Jerome Gropman, a senior physician at the Harvard Medical School. Very incredible. Very incredible. I've stolen some of these ideas from him. And there's one quote in there that I want to raise to you. At medical grand rounds in Boston, while talking about compassion and communication, Dr. Gropman was asked by a colleague, "There are primary care physicians in every hospital who speak with great sensitivity and concern, and their long-term patients love them, but clinically they are incompetent. How is a patient to know this?" So that's a problem. So when dealing with the doctor, be aware of the common cognitive errors in thinking. These things that, how are they thinking? Both by the doctor and the patient, because it's a human thing. It's everybody's. think of the three A's, anchoring, availability, attribution, and expect from your doctor the three C's, which I haven't discussed in detail, communication, critical reasoning, I mentioned, and compassion. So suggestions for patients, ask what else could it be? These are things you can talk to your doctor. Ask what else it could be. Combating satisfaction and of search bias and leading the doctor to consider a broader range of possibilities. Ask, is there anything that doesn't fit? Combating confirmation bias and, again, leading the doctor to think broadly. Ask if it is possible I have more than one problem, because multiple simultaneous disorders exist and frequently cause confusing symptoms. Tell what you are most worried about, opening discussion and leading either to reassurance, if it's the doctor will reassure you if it's not a problem, or further analysis if there's a cause for this worry. And then if there's a real problem and things are not going right, retell the story from the beginning. Details that are omitted in the initial telling may be recalled in a different context and may be clues may become more salient. Then this is most appropriate if it's a tough case. So that's how doctors think. In a nutshell, if Marina hinted subtly that I should actually give you some practical medical advice. And this is not my purpose, but I'm going to give you six pieces of medical advice. I think these are the best ones for your health. Number one, don't smoke. Number two, fasten your seatbelt. Number three, don't drink and drive. Number four, eat vegetables and fish. Number five, get your flu shot. And number six, exercise regularly. And you'll all live long, healthy lives. Okay.